Genesis 45. I do appreciate that. Thank you very much. Genesis 45. In Genesis 45, here's what we have. Keep in mind, you know, what's happened here. Twice now, Joseph's brothers have had to come to Egypt to get food. And after that first time, he gave them some qualifications if they were going to come again. All right, told them some things that they had to do. And one of those things was they had to bring Benjamin with them. So, of course, they're back again. They've got Benjamin. And so this whole scenario, you know, he let them go back. If you remember, he loaded up his silver cup in his bag so that he could send people out and arrest them and bring them back again. And so it was all set up. And so now he's got them back and he's dealing with them. And we ended chapter 44 with them just pouring their heart out unto Joseph, especially Judah, pouring his heart out and willing to take the place of Benjamin so that Benjamin could go home to his father, and Judah was willing to pay whatever penalty. And so that's kind of where we left everything, is in that situation. Now, in chapter 45, what we find is Joseph now is confident that his brothers have changed, confident they've passed the test, if you would, and they're confident that they love and care for Benjamin, they love and care for their father, and that they're willing to step up and do anything they need to do to keep from hurting their father and to be sure and protect Benjamin. They became people of their word. And that impressed Joseph. And so he realized that the days of the young men that sold him into slavery, you know, the days of when he was young and they sold him into slavery, are past. And he understands these guys have changed. Something's different in their life. And so he sees them in a more mature and with a greater love than they'd ever had before. And with that having been said, he decides now's the time to break it to them as to who he is. By the way, let me just kind of throw this in there, just interject this for a moment. Aren't you glad that people don't always remember you for who you used to be? You know, I don't want to be remembered for my worst moments. You know what I'm saying? And I'm thankful that people forgive me and care for me. One of the things, you've heard me do the 23rd Psalm, and I like to do it like God's surrounding love, you know, and how he just surrounds us, you know, beneath us in the green pastures, beside us in the still waters, inside of us as he restores our soul, in front of us, he prepares a table before us in the presence of our enemies, above us as he anoints our head with oil, and then behind us was that final one as he follows us with goodness and mercy. And I always use it like this. I am thankful that God is merciful, and he puts that behind me because that's where all my sins are. And he's merciful enough to forgive me. And I'm thankful for people that know things about me and are willing to look past those and forgive me for those. I'm thankful for people that let me change. You know, I have a friend, more of an associate, but I know him really well, and know him from jail ministry. And this guy, to look at him, you'd think he is the wildest, craziest guy in all the world, and he has been. I mean, his body is literally tattooed nearly head to toe. Amazingly, chose not to tattoo his face, but his whole neck and everything's all tattooed up. I mean, he just looks like a big tattoo. And he's got scars on him that are evident from past life. He has been an addict and has some repercussions from that and some things that are evident. But he came to know Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. Now he's pastoring. And it's kind of an amazing thing because when you look at him, you think, seriously? Some of his tattoos are not, I mean, he tries to cover them up because they are awful. They're not even choice tattoos. They're not even something that, you know, they're vulgar. Some of them are vulgar. Some of them are racist. Some of them are a lot of different things, and he's ashamed of them. But his body's covered in this. This is what he was. And he tries to cover some of those things up, but he's not who he seems to be. He's a man now who loves the Lord, shares Christ, studies, preaches, prays. He's a guy wholly committed unto God. And it's amazing. And you know what? I would imagine, and he's told me this. He said, I am so thankful that there are people that are willing to forgive me from who I used to be. He said, I have people in my church that are people I've wronged, people I've hurt. And he said, yet they've forgiven me, and they'll sit under my ministry. I think about that, and I think how incredible that really is. There's Joseph. His brothers hated him, sold him, and wanted to kill him, were talked into selling him into slavery, and yet he loves them, and he cares for them. Then Joseph could not refrain himself before all them that stood by him, and he cried, cause every man to go out from me. And there stood no man with him while Joseph made himself known unto his brethren. As you read down through here, verse 2, he says, and he wept aloud. Now, I mean to tell you, he is overwhelmed with all of this. How difficult must it have been for him to hold all this in for all this time? And then at this point, it's so overwhelming that he just openly breaks down. You know, I've often said that emotions cannot bring salvation, but salvation will almost always bring emotions. You know, there's something about that, you know. And what happens with him is he finds this instant relief being able to share these things with his brothers and to be able to rekindle this relationship with them and to have a better relationship than he's ever had with them because they've never loved him. And so here is a situation where everything has changed. His life has changed as well as their life having changed. And yet we find in all of this that he emotionally breaks down to the point where he weeps so unbelievably loud, uncontrollably. And we'll see that here in just a moment. So he was not simply teary-eyed. He was sobbing in such a way that everybody could hear him. In fact, notice that even the household of Pharaoh heard him sobbing. Now, I find that interesting because it never really is clear about how this house situation is laid out. I even tried to look on the internet and find some things, and I didn't get any real clarity. But I got to be real honest with you. Where my house sits and where my neighbor's house sits, we've got a side yard between us that's probably about the size of that wall to where I'm standing. And I don't know if they could cry loud enough for me to hear them in my house. I don't think so. They could, maybe. But I've never heard anything. The people that used to live there had four children, and they were crazy children, and I couldn't hear them when they were in the house. You know what I'm saying? What was the attachment here? I have to think that either his house and Pharaoh's were one and the same, and he had a portion of that, you know, or they were so close to one another, and obviously they didn't have, like, pane glass windows and that kind of thing, that he could hear. But I would have to think his relationship with Pharaoh must have been really close because they had to have lived, like, literally right on each other. For Pharaoh's household to hear him weep in such a fashion as this. And I know he's weeping loudly. I get all of that, but it would have to be extraordinarily loud for anybody beyond that to hear them, but they did. And so that's the situation, all right? Joseph asked about their father, and they couldn't even talk. The fear, you know, this is Joseph, we're in trouble. The fear apparently overwhelmed them to the point. They couldn't even speak. And so he asked him, he said, you know, he told him, he said, this is your brother Joseph. And so, you know, maybe they're sitting there and they're thinking, he's going to kill us. We're going to die right here. He knows what we were doing. He heard us talking when he was in the, you know, down in the pit. He knew what was going on. And so, you know, this is incredible. Not only that, but he's the most powerful man in the world. Literally. The most powerful man in the world. Surely he'd take vengeance on them as far as they were concerned. But here again, here's another type of Jesus that we find in Joseph. You know, Jesus, as he hung on the cross before all of those who wanted him to die, they had not long before cried out, crucify him, crucify him. They spitting on him, they're mocking him. You know, they're doing all of these things. And yet, what does Jesus say? Forgive them. Forgive them, for they know not what they do. So what we find here is this forgiving attitude. And by the way, when we see it in these men of God and we see it in Jesus Christ, now, I have to tell you, I can see things in Jesus Christ and think I ought to be at that. I ought to follow his example and I should do that. But down deep, I'll be real honest with you, I'm thinking, but he's Jesus. I mean, I'm not Jesus. You know, I need to follow that example and do my very best to be that, to be my very best at forgiving and caring and all of those kinds of things. But truth be known, I'm not Jesus. And I can sometimes justify my actions, whether that's right or wrong. I tend to do that. But when I look at men like Joseph, keep in mind, here is Joseph of the Old Testament. And that's significant because in the Old Testament, they don't have what we have. They don't have all the scriptures we have. Joseph had no scriptures. Not only did he not have scripture, but he didn't have the indwelling Holy Spirit like you and I do. There's so much he did not have, and yet we find in his actions a forgiveness that we ought to have. And I sometimes get angry with myself because I don't always see in myself the things that ought to be present. And I look in Joseph's life, and a guy like Joseph is an inspiration to me because I see that and I think, man, I should be more like that. And I have no excuse to not be like that. You know, I can excuse myself when I'm talking about Jesus, but I can't really excuse myself when I'm looking at a mere mortal, you know. And so when I look at that, I have to think in that way to some degree. And so, you know, that's the situation. Verses 4 through 8, I got to tell you, Joseph's spiritual insight in these verses is really amazing. And I want to read these verses because I think they're really important. He says, "And Joseph said unto his brethren, come near to me, I pray you. And they came near. And he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt." He said, I know the situation. I haven't forgotten what happened. Don't get me wrong here. I remember. By the way, just because we forgive people, that don't make us stupid. Amen? We don't just all of a sudden forget. You know, we talk about, you know, casting things into the, we call it the sea of forgetfulness. There's nothing in the Bible, by the way, that says sea of forgetfulness. He says he'll cast them into the sea and remember them no more, just so you know. Just if you ever look at that, try to look that up on your concordance or whatever, you'll not find it unless you play it that way. All right? But nonetheless, what I'm saying is God may be able to forgive us and let it go and never think of it again. We don't have that ability. I have to be real honest with you. I'm going to remember. I can forgive you like you can forgive me. But quite honestly, we still have this memory. It's hard to just block something out of our memory. We're, you know, we don't have the ability that God has in all of those things. And so he lets them know, listen, I know what took place. I forgive you for it. It's not that I'm going to hold you accountable for it, but understand, I haven't forgotten it. I know you sold me into slavery, all right? Now, therefore, be not grieved nor angry with yourselves, and this is an interesting verse, that you sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life. All right? He says, listen, don't be angry at yourselves over this. God used it in a great way. God used that to put me in the position that I'm in so that I can preserve your life during these 7 years of famine. And it's such an insight, and I think sometimes we really, really, really lack having that kind of an insight. Yeah. Well, yeah, and in one respect, I agree. In another respect, I disagree. I agree in that we can remember it, but we don't hold on to it like a grudge. We don't use it for evidence. We don't use it, you know, as leverage, all right? But we can't forget it. I know what's happened. You know, I can't even do that in my own life. There are things that I have begged God to forgive me, and I'm confident God has forgiven me. But the problem is I keep on remembering. Let me give you an example in Scripture. When they entered into Jericho, they sent the spies out first, and Rahab hid the spies and did all the things she did because basically what we find is through faith she trusted their God, all right? And, you know, let them down with the scarlet cord and all that kind of thing. And then when we read about that over in Hebrews, you would think that because of that, we would see her positive side, would we not? But when you see Rahab in chapter 11 of Hebrews, how does it describe her? Rahab the harlot. Why? Why? It's like, why? I mean, you would think that that would be forgiven. You would think that that'd be put behind her. You would think that those, but God makes a point of saying, Rahab the harlot. Like, I want you to remember she was a harlot. And I think the whole idea of that is to make sure we remember just how sinful we are and how much grace God gives, so that we realize that God uses that for good. Yeah.
Was it possible that back in that day, Rahab was a common name? And so when they said Rahab the harlot, it was to differentiate from other Rahab?
And that's quite possible. But I would have to think that if I was going to describe her, I mean, I would probably describe her more as Rahab of Jericho, or Rahab that helped the spies in Jericho. I just have a hard time thinking that I would remember her for her worst action. You know, I think I would probably associate it more with something good rather than something bad. And it puzzles me that God does that to some degree, but I think really that it's so that we can remember that God can use anyone and can forgive anyone. And I think it's a reminder of that, in my opinion. That's just my opinion, but I think that's what it is. Yeah. And that's a good point, because when he talks about being taken from the very presence of sin, I think you're right. I think those things won't be remembered anymore. I think those are the things that will be gone. Oh, boy. Yeah, because there's a lot of things, you know, and like it or not, there are people that, you know, you associate with things you'd like not to associate them with, you know. Yeah. And it's neat to be able to I'm going to be honest. I mean, it really is. It's neat to remember a wrong, perhaps, that someone did you, and to not find any bitterness in your heart about it. There is something about that, in all honesty, really feels good. There is, a great peace when you can look at that and say, I know the wrong that was committed here, but I really have no bitterness, no anger. I don't hold a grudge. And that's a very peaceful thing. And you know that's from God. It's got to be. You know, and it's a confidence that you can have in that. That's a good point. Let me read these other verses, and then we'll come back to this. Now, therefore, be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that you sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years hath the famine been in the land. By the way, that 2 years, it gives you another little record of where we're at. All right, so now we're up to what, 22 years? Okay, since he left, is that right? So it just gives you another little record of where we're at. And says, and yet there are 5 years in that which there'll neither be earing nor harvest. So this is the first time that the people of Canaan realized this famine's going to go on another 5 years. All right? Joseph reveals it to them. Listen, this famine's going to go on 7 years. It's been here for 2 years. Got another 5 years coming. So you guys, we're going to have to do something, because it's going to be too difficult for you if we don't. All right? And God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity on the earth, to save your lives by great deliverance. So now it was not you that sent me hither. Listen to this verse. So now it was not you that sent me hither, but God. He hath made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. Interesting passage, verse 8. What we find is this insight that Joseph has is this. Listen, I realize, guys, that all of this was from God. God's desire was to put me right here for this time, for this day, and whatever means that needed to be done to put me here. It was God that put me here. And in so doing, it was so that he could preserve the people of promise. He made promises to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. And to preserve those promises and to keep their lineage alive, he's using me to do that, to bring you here so that you can flourish and not be in a land full of famine. He says, and I get that God's been in all of this. I can't hold you accountable, because I know that this has been the hand of God. Now, with all that having been said, I'm going to get into what in some circles is a very touchy thing. And I'm going to open it with Romans 8:28. By the way, Romans 8:28 is my life verse. If you ever say, you know, I would really love, maybe you're crafty or something, I'd really love to make Barry something with his life verse on it, just remember Romans 8:28. It's my life verse, all right? And it's simply this, and we know all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. It doesn't say in that verse that all things are good. But it says that God can use all things for good. And so what happens is God can take whatever takes place and whatever happens in our life and make something incredible out of it. And so, you know, it's an incredible thing. Let me give you some examples. I mean, was it good for Joseph's brothers to want to kill Joseph? Of course not. Was it good that they sold him into slavery? It's not a brotherly thing, is it? Was it good for Potiphar's wife to accuse him of sexual harassment? Of course not. Was it good that he spent time in jail? I mean, if you ask him, he'd probably say, no, I didn't want to spend time in jail. Was it good that the butler totally forgot to mention him to Pharaoh? But yet God used every one of those things to bring him to right where he stands. And so sometimes we deal with a lot of bad things to bring us to where God can fully use us. Because God will take all of those things and work them one to the other, to the next, to put us right where he wants us to be. So Joseph made it clear to his brothers that God had used all of these things to preserve life in the midst of famine and to be a testimony to the house of Pharaoh. I'm like a father to Pharaoh. Pharaoh comes to me for advice. Pharaoh comes to me, and I mean, he's the leader of the entire world, and yet he comes to me for advice and leadership. So it makes him literally the ruler of the world. But that's where it is. Now, here's what I want to talk about for just a moment, and this is where controversy sometimes comes in. We talk about two wills of God. We talk about God's sovereign will, which means the things that God tells us are going to take place are going to happen, and nobody can keep it from it. When you read Revelation, you see all these things that are going to take place. There's nothing that anybody in this world can do to alter that. It's going to happen. It's God's sovereign will. There might even be things in your life, by the way, as a child of God, that is his sovereign will, and nobody can change that. However, God also has a permissive will. He has given us a free will and will allow us to make bad decisions. All right? And that having been said, this is a picture. These are some things that you're going to see in this passage where it gives us pictures of sovereign will versus permissive will. Yeah.
Is that what a Calvinist is?
I think so. Calvinists go by a lot of different names. If you hear these names and you don't understand, Calvinism, Doctrines of Grace, Reform. Those are the three names that you will basically hear them use of themselves. But all of them mean the same thing. They all mean we're Calvinist, okay? And for those of you that don't know what we're talking about when I say that, a Calvinist is someone that believes that God's sovereign will is the only will. That God's will is, you know, if God wills for this person to be saved, they will be saved. It may be God's will that you are not going to be a saved individual, therefore you cannot be saved. That's basically what they believe and what they teach. I believe it to be a false doctrine, but I'm just telling you that's what they believe and that's what they teach. There's some problems with all of that, in my estimation. Let me throw, I wasn't going to do this, but being she mentioned it, let me just throw this at you. True Calvinist, Reformed, Doctrines of Grace kind of people have to say, because God created all things, and all things were created for him, by him and for him, okay? Now, when we look at this, and we get this picture, keep in mind that if they believe that you cannot keep from being a sinner or from dying in your sins, that you can't do anything to prevent that, you can't trust Christ if you are one of those who he has preselected not to, predetermined is not going to, then you have to say that God created sin, created it for those who are not going to be saved. All right? Now, if you just stop there, you might be able to justify that. And I've heard Calvinists, even some, I don't know about all, but some that I've talked to, they say, well, he had to have created sin. He did create sin. The problem with that is he does say all things were created by him and what? For him. That being the case, you would have to say that if he created sin, sin was created to please him. Which means if you sin, it's pleasing unto him. You see the problem with that? I mean, there's a real problem with going in that circle because you have to determine that even things that are evil were created by God. Therefore, those evil things were made to please him, because he said all things were created by him and for him. And I can't imagine evil things being created for him, evil being created for him, sin being created for him. And what sin is basically is rebellion against all those things that God did create and did do. So, you know, we have the ability to reject what God has given, what God has made. He says the light came into the world, but we chose what? Darkness. All right? How could we choose darkness if we had no choice? All right? So he tells us clearly we have a choice. Now, this is where his permissive will comes in. God will allow things to take place in our life that are not good. He will allow bad decisions to take place in our life. He will allow even things, I mean, it rains on the just and the unjust. He will allow you as his children to sometimes suffer because sin is in the world. Just because you're a saved individual, I'm going to tell you, it doesn't make you immune from diseases in the world. Doesn't make you immune from tragedy. Doesn't make you immune from that guy walking down the street with a gun trying to shoot up people. Doesn't make you immune from those things. We live in a sinful world, and we're subject to that sin because in his permissive will, he allows those things to take place. Now, what he doesn't do is allow that permissive will to interfere with his sovereign will. All right? That's why he says he can make all things good, to work all things together for good. All right? That's why he says that, because he can take what mistakes we make in our permissive will to work hand in hand to accomplish his sovereign will. All right? Now, with that having been said, you begin to really kind of look at some of these things, and you kind of get a little bit of a grip on this. God did not make Joseph's brothers sell him into slavery. He did not make them want to kill him. They did that. And God used that. However, that's in his permissive will. He allowed that to happen. However, in his sovereign will, although they wanted to kill him, in his sovereign will, he didn't allow that to happen. All right? Instead, he allowed them to sell him into slavery rather than to do something that would disrupt his plan and what he was going to have happen. While Joseph was in the house of Potiphar, God, in his permissive will, allowed Potiphar's wife to sexually harass Joseph and then accuse him of having sexually harassed her. All right? That's not necessarily in God's will, but God, in his sovereign will, used that to put him right in the place he needed him to put him, in the jail where he could bring him to a place where he could be known by the people that he needed to be known by and all those kinds of things. So he used things that took place in his permissive will to enact his sovereign will. All right. So when you look at this and you just keep working that ladder, you get the idea of what I'm saying. But it's his sovereign will that's going to be done. Now, when we look at that, we say, well, what if, and we could throw all kinds of hypotheticals out there, what if his brothers didn't hate him? God would have found a different way to put Joseph where he needed to put him. It's a sovereign will that Joseph be where he was in Egypt. It's a sovereign will. And God was going to put him in charge as a ruler in Egypt regardless. And it wouldn't have mattered about what would have taken place otherwise. It was his sovereign will to do that, and it was going to take place. So that's what I'm trying to say. There are decisions that we can make that are poor decisions. We can make bad decisions, and God will allow us to make those bad decisions, but ultimately his will is going to be accomplished, and we can't do anything to deter that, all right? I find it kind of comical at times. I have pastor friends that do this, and I almost laugh, but they'll talk about, you know, and don't get me wrong when I say what I'm going to say, because I think we have an obligation to put the right people in office, and I think we have the right obligation to pray about who we're voting for and all those kinds of things, so don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But I have pastor friends who will say things like, you know, finally we have this person in office that will put us where we need to be with Israel, or that will put us, you know, boy, it's good. Well, I got news for you. God's plan with Israel, we're not going to disrupt it whether we're on their side or off their side. You're not going to change anything. Really isn't going to change any of that. But now Israel's capital is where it ought to be. Well, maybe God's using that to put it where it ought to be, but by the same token, keep in mind that God's going to do it regardless. We can't mess up God's plan. As much as we'd like to think that we can mess up God's plan. We're not going to mess up God's plan. He still has a plan for Israel that's going to come to pass. Whether we like it or not, we're not going to prevent the 7 years tribulation. We are not going to prevent the Antichrist from coming. We are not going to prevent Christ's return. We are not going to prevent any of those things from happening, no matter what we do as a nation or as a family or anything else. What we need to focus on and what we really need to concentrate on is the commands that God has given us, and the commands that he has given us is to share the gospel with the lost in a dying world, and that's what we are to do. All right, that's my focus. Now, granted, I want to live in peace, and yeah, I want a government that's going to allow me to continue to do these things, but ultimately, it's God's will that's going to be done. And you know what? The lost world is the lost world, and the lost world is going to do what lost worlds do. All right? And so, that's just the way it is. All right? And so, that's the situation. So, he's just making sure that they understand, listen, I know who you are, I know what you've done. I'm not ignorant to all of that. I remember all these things, but understand that regardless of what takes place, I understand and I know that God used that to put me right where I am, so I'm not angry with you, you know? And so God's work and God's plan has been fulfilled. What an insight for Joseph to have, and what an insight for him to come to recognize and to know that God's will is going to be done, period, all right, in the end, all right? In the midst of all the folly, in the end, his will is going to be done. You realize you do that with your children, don't you? If you have a goal for a child, let's say, I don't know, whatever it is, maybe you're trying to get them to eat peas, all right, whatever it might be, you know in your heart, it's not just my will that they eat these peas. Before they get up from that chair, they're going to eat these peas, all right? And you know that's going to happen. That's going to be the end result. Now, you might be pretty lenient for a little while. You'll let them throw some of the peas on the floor. You'll let them give a shot with the spoon until they get to playing with it and doing crazy things. And in your permissive will, you'll let them get by so far, but when it gets right down to brass tacks, you're not getting up from there until you eat those peas. God's like that. He will allow some folly on our part, but in the end, his will is going to be done.